Okay, well, some of us who are a little older may have grown up, well, would have grown up in another church and may have had the privilege of performing in a children's Christmas play. So can I see the hands of those who, as a kid, you were forced to wear some homemade costume in order to play the role of an angel or shepherd or wise man or other character? Look at this. Okay. Ben, what were you? What did you play?
I don't remember if it was Joseph or Wiseman.
Okay, Steph.
I'm pretty sure I was an angel. What would you expect?
Yeah. What would you expect? Of course. How many people played angels? Everybody. You didn't even hold up your hand earlier.
I did.
All right. Well, they always gave me the non-speaking parts, you know, like the donkey. But no comment on that. All right. Well, today there's no children's play, but some of what we will be covering from the second chapter of Matthew is often portrayed in such plays. So let's go ahead and turn there at this time, if you would. And in this chapter, Matthew lays out a timeline where after the birth of Jesus, his family continues to live in Bethlehem, perhaps up to a couple years. Then they go to Egypt to escape King Herod. And after Herod dies, they head back to Israel, but end up going not to Bethlehem, but to Nazareth instead. So the family is jostled about by circumstances beyond their control all through this. It's not like Joseph laid out some carefully crafted plan that they were following. This is a familiar story to everyone. You've heard it many, many, many times. And last week we covered chapter 1. Today we'll be looking here at chapter 2. And so we'll begin with the first half, and that would be verses 1 through 2. And I have asked Patty Lobb, who does such a wonderful job of reading, to read the first 12 verses. So Patty, won't you come on up at this time?
After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east, and we have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. "In Bethlehem in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel." When Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star appeared, he sent them to Bethlehem and say, "Go and make a careful search for the child, and as soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went on ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and they worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route.
Thank you, Patty. Okay, as chapter 2 opens, we see that things have now actually jumped ahead several months, possibly up to 2 years. A major point that Matthew wants to establish, especially for his Jewish readership, is the fact that the Messiah must be born in the city of David, Bethlehem, which is Bethlehem. And this is rooted in a prophecy by Micah, which Matthew quotes in verse 6. And as Matthew points out, that is true of Jesus. And he's not just from Bethlehem, but the prophet also declares that the Messiah must descend from the line of Judah. And Matthew points this out in the earlier part of his genealogy back in chapter 1. Now, all of this does not mean, of course, that Jesus is the Messiah, but it does establish the fact that he at least meets those particular qualifications. Now, regarding the timeline, we do find that Matthew's account is a bit different than Luke's. I don't know if you ever noticed that, but there is no contradiction here. Matthew has Jesus in Bethlehem for a year or so, perhaps up to 2 years, before his family ends up in Nazareth. Luke has Jesus and his family going to Nazareth when he was only 8 days old, right after he was presented in the temple. So on the surface, there seems to be a discrepancy, but this is simply, and we've talked about this in the past, simply a matter of each writer choosing what to include in their account and what to leave out. Matthew does not mention the presentation in the temple. Luke doesn't mention the period of time that the family lived in Bethlehem following that presentation. They both, however, tell us that the family does end up in Nazareth, which then becomes the place where Jesus grows up. That's his hometown. So there are differences like this all through the Gospels. You have noticed them, where different authors will choose to include some events and not others based on their particular purposes. But when we put it all together, we can reconstruct a pretty good picture of the whole thing, like when it comes time for children's Christmas plays, right? We put it all together. About 60 years before this time now, to give a little bit of a historical context, the great Roman general Pompey had advanced on Jerusalem and captured the city along with the rest of Palestine. And then, around 20 years after that, the Romans installed a local figure, Herod, to rule over it for them. Herod was not really a Jew, but he did have a distant connection with the Jews, and his family descended from Jacob's brother Esau. But the promise, as we know, was passed on through Jacob. Esau, what did he do with his promise? He sold it for a bowl of stew. So now, to keep things straight, because there's several Herods mentioned in the New Testament, this is not the Herod that Jesus appeared before shortly before his crucifixion. We are now talking about this guy's dad, and he is known as Herod the Great. And in the movies, he's always portrayed as cruel, ruthless, and very paranoid, and actually he was. Obsessed with fear that others were out to get him, he had, over the years, killed a brother-in-law, a wife's grandmother, 2 of his 10 wives, there's several things disturbing about that, and at least 3 of his own sons. Caesar Augustus coined the expression, better to be Herod's pig than Herod's son. Though he was a ruthless tyrant, his achievements were of such that he merited the title Herod the Great. He was a great builder. In fact, it was because of him that the temple in Jerusalem was rebuilt. One historian says of him, he was the only ruler of Palestine who ever succeeded in keeping the peace and in bringing order into disorder. But his achievements did little to offset the bad. When he was about to die, he ordered for the arrest of all Jewish leaders. He knew that people would rejoice over his death. He knew he was hated. And so he decreed that upon his last breath, all of these leaders would be executed immediately. His reasoning was simply this: though there be no mourning for my death, there will be mourning at my death. Now, fortunately, the edict was not carried out. But the fact that he would order the slaughter of the youngest of children just to eliminate a potential threat to his throne, as we will read about later in this chapter, well, that is actually quite telling, isn't it? But apparently, when he invited the Magi into his chambers, he was able to disguise his true self and play the part of someone who is trustworthy and sincere and harmless. Indeed, the Magi had every intention of reporting back to him and would have had it not been for a warning that they received in a dream. So let's now turn our attention to them. The Magi have always been somewhat of a mystery. Though Matthew refers to them as Magi, a popular Christmas carol refers to them as kings, as we sing about this morning. Not all Magi are kings, but it is possible that the ones who visited Jesus were not really sure about that, but it's possible. And this idea enjoyed support very early on in church history because of a couple verses in the Old Testament that refer to kings of the earth presenting their wealth to the Lord. And included in what's mentioned in that would be gold and incense. And so people have made that connection. Now, Magi were well educated. They devoted themselves to discovering and understanding mysteries of the world. And so based on this, we could refer to them as wise men as well. They studied the stars, both astronomy and astrology. They tried to interpret the meaning of signs in the night sky, the arrangements of the constellations, the zodiac. They studied a variety of the sciences, sought out wisdom from various cultures. They dabbled in magical arts and were especially intrigued by dreams and attempted to interpret their meanings. So these sorts of things. Historians claim that they were most likely grounded in the teachings of Zoroaster, if you've ever heard of him. Though Magi are found all over the Roman world, they were especially associated with the areas of Persia and Babylonia to the east. Real quick, anyone know the difference between Babylon and Babylonia? Babylon is the city, the capital city, and Babylonia is the region. However, it's quite common back then to use the name of the city for the whole region or country. So to put things in context, Babylonia, that area, would be more or less in modern-day Iraq. Now, we could assume that the Magi had been exposed to Old Testament prophecies. It's easy enough to connect those dots, although many Jews had returned to Palestine after the exile. Many remained, especially in Babylon. They settled down there, established colonies there, and through them it is suggested that the Magi came to learn about the Jewish scriptures, Jewish prophecies, and probably even the promises of a coming Messiah. We can't say for sure, but this is all certainly plausible. Historians have speculated that if the Magi who visited Jesus did come from Babylon, using the route available for them at that time would have meant a 900-mile journey, consisting of several months to complete. Now, the Bible gives us no clue on how many there were. Tradition in the Eastern Church puts the number at 12. Tradition in the Western Church puts the number at 3, based on the 3 gifts that were presented to Jesus. Whatever their number, they likely traveled with a lot of attendants and guards for the long journey. Their goal, of course, was to find the one who has been born King of the Jews. We are not sure at this point if the star that guided them was something moving in the sky that they followed, or if it was something related to the zodiac that they interpreted, at least initially here. The meaning of that would have led them westward toward the city of David, Jerusalem. So the words in verse 2 would allow for that when they simply said that we saw his star. Now, whatever the case, once in Jerusalem, they began asking around, thinking, of course, that everyone in the city would know about this newborn king. But what do they find? Everybody is clueless. Nobody knows what they're talking about. And this visit stirs things up. Word gets back to Herod, and so he summons the chief priests and teachers of the law in order to find out if there could be something to all of this. If indeed a king of the Jews has been born, he wants to know how old he is and where he is. And from the Jewish leaders, he is given at least the place, Bethlehem. And from the Magi, he gets somewhat of a time frame based on when they saw the star, and therefore an estimate of his age. So let's now talk about the star. Whatever it is, Magi are utterly convinced by it. The idea that a special star heralded the birth of famous people and other significant events was widespread in the ancient world. The Magi were probably aware of Herod's royal position and may have assumed that a birth had taken place within his family. The phrase, in the east, can mean either the locale or direction, like east, or it could also mean rising. Because of the rotation of the earth, everything rises in the east, and so that term came to have both meanings. The question has always been, if the Magi are from the east and the star rose in the east, how could they follow it toward the west, toward Jerusalem? Well, two possibilities. It could be that the star rose in the west, and that is what made it different and special. It'd be a very unusual and odd thing to happen. Or again, it could have been that they didn't actually follow the star itself at this point, but were simply guided by how they interpreted its meaning. Whatever the case, the star is the reason they believe a king has been born and the reason they headed west toward Jerusalem to find him. Now, there have been over the years, and you're aware of this, several theories offered up as to the nature of this star. Some have claimed that it could have that it was just astrological. For instance, in 7 BC, just a year or so before Jesus was born, there was in the constellation of Pisces a conjunction of both Jupiter and Saturn, like there was earlier this week. Same conjunction, but a different constellation. So to ancient astrologers like the Magi, you know, Jupiter was the royal planet, Saturn represented the lands to the west, and Pisces represented the last days. And so any Magi worth his salt would have concluded that a great ruler of the last days has now appeared in Palestine. Astrology and the zodiac saturated the culture of the elites so much back then that Augustus Caesar actually defended his right to rule by publishing his horoscope on coins. Another explanation, very common, is astronomical. The star was an unusual event in the night sky, but nonetheless, it was natural, something that could be explained by science. Many astronomers have tried to make a case that it was a comet, others that it was a conjunction of planets, others yet a supernova, which would be a star that had exploded, make it very bright. Most of us have been exposed to these theories at one time or another. Much effort has been spent in making one of those plausible by scientists. But the devil is in the details, as they say. None of these natural explanations can explain this phenomenon of the star first rising, then leading on the Magi, and eventually stopping, as we see the text write about. Whatever is going on, it is, at least from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, at least from there, in that segment, it is moving, and its movements do not correspond to what we would expect from something natural, something that could be explained by modern science. And so, among Christians, the most popular view is that the star was indeed a supernatural phenomenon caused by God. And given the prominent place the angel of the Lord had in guiding different people in this chapter, perhaps it is offered up that the star was actually that angel. After all, in the scriptures, angels are often referred to as stars. So it's hard to say on that particular point, but along this line, some have also suggested that perhaps only the Magi were able to see it, whatever it was. It is interesting that in verse 7, Herod, for instance, doesn't seem to know anything about the star. So whatever was at work, it did guide the Magi, and the Magi had no doubts about it guiding them. Now, I remember when I was around 5 or 6 years old, going outside at night on Christmas Eve, looking for that star myself. Did anyone else do that? I was the only one. And I was very disappointed when my mother finally came outside telling me that it would not be there. I mean, this was a real crisis of faith. I mean, if I can't see that star myself, how do I know that it was real? My second crisis of faith came a few years later during the same time period when my mother sat me down and told me the truth about Santa Claus. That was hard to survive as well. And I was 18 at that time. And I'm still wounded from that. All right. Once they arrive in Jerusalem, Herod invites the Magi into his place for drinks, dinner, proceeds to smooze them with, "I would love to find this newborn king myself. It is only fitting that I worship him as well. Promise me that you will come back and tell me where you found him." So the Jewish scribes tell Herod that the place to start looking would be, based on ancient prophecies, Bethlehem. And so that is where the Magi head off to. Bethlehem is only 5 or 6 miles away from Jerusalem, and it is itself a small town, around 1,000 or less. But the question remains, where in Bethlehem? If the people in Bethlehem were clueless, then the people in Bethlehem will probably be clueless as well. How will they find him? So at this point, the star that had guided them to Jerusalem now guides them to that very house, and does so by actually moving in the sky and stopping. And the whole thing is quite fascinating, though admittedly there's much here that we just do not know. But we do know that the Magi were overwhelmed with joy when the star led them specifically to the right place. They were, however, probably underwhelmed once they arrived at the house. Joseph, Mary, and Jesus would not strike them as members of royalty. When approaching royalty, gifts were often brought to pay homage, show courtesy, respect, reverence. So let's now turn our attention to that, to these gifts. The first thing we notice about them is that they are luxurious, they are expensive, they are gifts fit for a king, intended to be given from the affluent to the affluent. Gold then, as it is now, is the symbol of ultimate value. Incense or frankincense was used as a treasured perfume. It was used ceremonially on the altar, representing prayers and worship going up to God as a sweet aroma for him. And myrrh is the sap that comes from a small tree found in Arabia and was used for just a lot of things. It was used in incense and perfume, so on. We know from Mark's account of the crucifixion that wine mixed with myrrh was offered to Jesus on the cross, and it was also used for embalming. Now, all of this gold and exotic spices would not normally come within the budget of an ordinary Jewish family. And so we can assume that Joseph and Mary were overwhelmed when it was being presented. The picture here really is something. The Magi came expecting to find a royal baby born in a royal family, all living in a royal palace. And now what they find is something altogether different. And I would imagine that upon, you know, seeing their house and getting ready to come into it, at least one of them would have said, there must be some mistake. We have to be at the wrong place. Now, there is, of course, a long history of interpreting these gifts as symbols, gold representing Christ's kingship, incense, his deity, myrrh, his sacrificial death and burial. And indeed, like the song we sang this morning, that it kind of capitalizes on that tradition. There may actually be some merit to this, but it would be reading too much into things to suggest that the Magi themselves had such intentions. It is doubtful, possible, but doubtful that they understood all that Jesus was. They came looking for a king, not a savior, and not God in the flesh. It is, however, worth noting that the first ones to worship Jesus, at least that the scriptures tell us about, are not members of his own people, but Gentiles, and not just Gentiles, but Magi, astrologers, sorcerers, pagans. It's really fascinating. And we do not know, however, whatever happened to these gifts. It would not be surprising to see another Indiana Jones sequel occupied with the quest of finding those gifts. But most likely, they were probably sold soon after to support not just the family's flight into Egypt, but also the time that they stayed there. So we recognize all this just being part of God's oversight and providence. The Magi, as we see, are warned in a dream to not return to Herod instead of retracing their steps back through Jerusalem, where Herod awaits them. They returned home using a different route. Herod's long arm of military security covered virtually every route in and out of Jerusalem and the surrounding towns, and so they and their entourage must have moved swiftly and as secretly as possible. Now, some have wondered why Herod did not send an escort with them. This would ensure a correct report back to Herod, or even to carry out the intended assassination there and then. But Herod, as we know, had a liking for the use of undercover agents, and taking an armed escort could have actually jeopardized the mission. He needed everything to look very natural, and plus he had no reason to not trust the Magi. So the results are both good and bad. Because they do not return to Herod, Jesus is spared, but as we see in the following verses, others die. Innocent children, 2 years old and under. So, Pat, if you'd want to come and pick it up from there, starting with verse 13.
When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said. "Take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so it was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious. He gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more. After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who are trying to take the child's life are dead." So he got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, "He will be called a Nazarene."
Okay, once the Magi escaped safely, the angel of the Lord appears, as we read here, in a dream to warn Joseph about Herod's scheme to kill Jesus. This is his third dream where God has given him specific guidance. Matthew's account is quite brief and basic. He tells us nothing of that journey, except that it began at night, or where the family lived in Egypt, or of how that time in Egypt was spent. The detail about setting off at night does, however, underscore the urgency of the situation. Now, Egypt is about 80 miles south of Bethlehem, and once you cross the border, it is a difficult journey from there to any town of substance, another 70 miles or so to any place livable. Historians suggest that Joseph may have headed toward Alexandria. This would be a very large city, and at that time, it included a population of around 1 million Jews. The city was a natural place for Jews to seek asylum when facing political danger. In fact, according to Josephus, a substitute temple had even been built by Jewish exiles living there. In verse 15, Matthew refers to the flight to Egypt and the return from it as a fulfillment of Scripture. And so on this, we might think of that brief discussion we had last Sunday regarding Matthew's claim that the supernatural conception of Jesus fulfilled an ancient prophecy found in Isaiah. Hopefully some of the stuff will kick into play here for you. Sometimes a scripture is fulfilled much in the same way we think of as a prediction coming true, but there are other ways like typology. And oftentimes something in the earthly life or ministry of Jesus will, by means of an analogy, correspond to something in Israel's history. Matthew sees a striking parallel here with Jesus living in Egypt, or specifically leaving Egypt, and something the prophet Hosea said when he was recalling how God had faithfully brought Israel out of Egypt in the Exodus. So Matthew doesn't see these similarities as coincidence and claims there's something deeper going on here. Though he doesn't elaborate on it, we could speculate something along these lines. Just as God brought the nation of Israel out of Egypt to inaugurate his original covenant with them, so again, God is bringing the Messiah, who fulfills the hopes of Israel, out of Egypt to inaugurate his new covenant. Now, Herod, being paranoid that he is, takes this news of a newborn king of Israel very seriously. He is serving as a king of the Jews, but does so because Rome appointed him. This child, however, whoever he is, wherever he is, has been born king of the Jews. And this is altogether different. The child enjoys an ancestral right that he does not. Eventually, he figures out that the Magi weren't coming back, that they have fled, and so he takes the situation into his own hands. Any potential challenger to his throne has to be eliminated, no exceptions. And based on his earlier conversation with the Magi about the timing of the star, he figures this newborn king of the Jews would still be under 2 years old. And so soldiers are sent to Bethlehem to kill them all boys under two. Matthew's narrative does not necessarily mean that a full 2 years had elapsed since the original sighting of the star by Magi. Herod just wanted to be absolute sure that he gets everyone. Skeptics have pointed out that something this tragic would have surely been noted in other works of history during that same time period, yet nothing at all is ever mentioned about this outside of Scripture. And that is curious. But there are a couple reasons for that. Those killed were Jews in a little rural town, a town that held no significance to the Romans. And even though they were young children, this would not have been seen as anything important enough to be noted in history books, especially in light of Herod's other horrific actions. On the scale of all his other atrocities, this would actually register somewhat low. And, more to the point, the number of boys who were killed was not nearly as large as what is often portrayed in the movies and paperback novels. Christian tradition has inflated the number of babies involved in this massacre into several thousands. Estimates, however, of the total population of Bethlehem in the first century are generally under 1,000 people, which would mean that the number of male children up to 2 years old at any one time would have been between 12 and 20. Now, terrible as such a slaughter would have been for the local community, it is not on a scale to match the more spectacular assassinations by Herod. And again, this does not minimize the tragedy. It simply explains why we don't find any reference to it outside Matthew's account. Now, to help us appreciate the context of this, given the size of Bethlehem, we could easily speculate that this was a somewhat tight community, the sort of place where everyone knew each other, even if you had not lived there that long. And so it is quite likely that Mary and Joseph probably knew these children and knew the parents of them. And these were boys that probably had interacted with, played with Jesus as a toddler. It's a sobering thing to think about. Matthew speaks of Bethlehem's grief as a tragic reminder of the heartache experienced earlier in Israel's history, fulfilling what was said to the prophet Jeremiah. Centuries earlier, Nebuchadnezzar's army had gathered the captives from Judah into a town of Ramah before they were taken in exile to Babylon. Jeremiah portrays Rachel, who serves as a personification of all the mothers of Israel, mourning for the children as they are being carried away into that exile. And so again, this is not fulfillment in the sense of a prediction coming to pass, but rather is yet another case of using analogies and typology. Nebuchadnezzar's attempts to crush God's chosen people points to Herod's attempts to eliminate God's chosen king. Soon after, Herod, history tells us, he became deathly ill. He died in his palace at the age of 69, around March or April of 4 BC. When trying to calculate the date of Christ's birth, historians generally start with the date of Herod's death, and they then add that decree to kill those two 2-year-olds or under, and this puts the birth of Jesus sometime between 4 BC and 6 BC, and that's about as close as we can get to that. The angel appears once again to Joseph in a dream and instructs him to take his family back to Israel because the threat from Herod is over. Herod's son, Archelaus, has now become the ruler over Judea and Samaria. He too was cruel and ruthless, so much so that the emperor feared a revolt from the people, and so he was eventually removed. Joseph's son learns that Archelaus is now ruling in place of his father, and understandably, he's afraid to return. However, Archelaus does not enjoy the same reach that his father did. He is only the ruler of Samaria and Judea, not Galilee. And one of his brothers is now over Galilee. And so Joseph receives guidance in yet another dream to go on toward Galilee, which would be another 80 miles or so north of Bethlehem. And this then, of course, would have been a very long journey, a very difficult journey for the family of Jesus, especially if they were coming from Alexandria. As to be expected, they ended up back in their hometown of Nazareth, which is in the region of Galilee. Nazareth was a small little rural town of about 500 people. It was off the beaten path, kind of a hidden back in a secluded valley. It had no political, military, economic, religious, or social significance whatsoever. and they are safe there as a result. The family of Jesus is far away from all the political schemings and rivalry and maneuverings of Jerusalem. Jesus will grow up there, and as a result, he will be called, in verse 23, a Nazarene. And this itself does not seem to be all that noteworthy, but Matthew again sees something about that which has prophetic significance. And what Matthew claims is a bit intriguing for a couple of reasons. First, there is no specific prophecy in the Old Testament claiming that the Messiah would be called a Nazarene. So where's this coming from? And secondly, to make matters worse, so to speak, Matthew claims that this is not what a prophet foretold, but what prophets, plural, foretold, more than just one. So what's going on here? Was Matthew making a reckless claim? Are there other prophets that he might be referring to that we don't know anything about? Well, no to both of those possibilities. The fact is, Matthew is not referring to any specific prophecy in the Old Testament. Indeed, he does not quote from any, as he typically does. Instead, he is drawing upon a general theme common to many of the prophets, namely, that the Messiah would be despised and rejected, regarded as an outcast. And that is exactly the image of one who is from Nazareth. This is a remote, poor, backwards, scuzzy little town. To say that you are from there is to invite ridicule, and to be called a Nazarene is to be ridiculed. One would be hard-pressed to find a village with less significance. There isn't anything there to attract anyone to it. Nothing. It isn't mentioned anywhere in the Old Testament, in the Apocrypha, in the Talmud, or by the historian Josephus. In fact, there have been in the past a handful of historians who have doubted that the town even existed. And so this really is the picture of lowliness, of inferiority. To be called a Nazarene has the same effect as being called a racial slur today. You may remember the time when Philip told Nathanael about Jesus of Nazareth. Remember Nathanael's response? How can anything good come out of Nazareth? I mean, this captures the sentiment of that day. So Jesus did not grow up as Jesus the Bethlehemite, with its prestigious overtones of belonging to the beloved city of David, or as Jesus of Judah with his ancestral right to be king, but rather as Jesus the Nazarene with all of its scorn and sneer. And this is how Matthew's birth narrative concludes. And in fact, it appears that everything has been leading up to this very point. The Messiah did not come with fanfare or glory, but in obscurity. Not born into a royal family, living in a royal palace, but in less than comfortable settings. His first breath, probably the smell of farm animals, probably that of manure. His parents were suspected of promiscuity. He, the result of fornication, born out of wedlock. He and his family fled with powerless humility at night to Egypt. And his arrival in history was surrounded with grief and sorrow when the infant boys were slaughtered in Bethlehem, and now would be raised in that little ratty village known as Nazareth, a symbol of a backwoods hick. In light of this chapter in Matthew, Paul's words in Philippians 2 become even more striking. He did not consider equality with God something to be exploited for his own personal gain, but made himself nothing. And so in conclusion, I would just go back and remind everyone of the purpose for working through these two chapters. There is a lot of information here. It's a lot of history, a lot of background, reference to culture, a lot of details. But hopefully, it helps to paint a more complete picture of the events surrounding the birth of our Savior. And to help us better appreciate that, from the very beginning, he really did make himself nothing. He really is the picture of humility that he preached, the picture of laying aside rights and privileges, the picture of not grasping for what he was genuinely entitled to, exploiting his advantage, but instead he took on the very nature of a lowly servant. So let us joyfully give thanks for this grand plan of salvation that we have benefited from, as well as the example that he set for us. In the book of Acts, the followers of Jesus were mocked and scorned, at one point even referred to as belonging to the, quote, Nazarene sect. And as a final exhortation today, may we bear similar words of ridicule and disparagement with both joy and boldness. And in 2 weeks from today, I hope to talk more about that. in particular. And I just realized I forgot to ask somebody to come and close for me. So Josh or Dave or Tim, who would like to volunteer to close the service? They're all looking at each other, drawing straws. Since Josh is the one that gets paid, we'll have him come up and close the service. I think that's what you whispered to him, right, Dave?